Is there good reason to justify time travel? Was the Unabomber right about some things? Is there anything worse than a laugh track? These are some of the questions cultural critic Chuck Klosterman asks in his new book, Eating the Dinosaur, a series of essays on a range of topics such as Nirvana versus the Waco Massacre, why Weezer fans are continually disappointed by the band's new albums, and how the NFL has a conservative appearance but a liberal mindset. In Eating the Dinosaur, Klosterman explores the disconnect between reality and the world constructed by the media, and which one we tend to accept as the truth. Eating the Dinosaur is published by Scribner, and it's brought Chuck Klosterman to the Leonard LoPage Show today. I'm Julie Burstyn. I forgot to mention that at the top, but welcome, Chuck Klosterman.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for telling me that it's Klosterman, not Klosterman.
I know. I always tell people that because it does look like Klosterman. There's no reasonable reason that people would say Klosterman. But I figure, I usually don't even...
But that's the way your dad said it,
and
that's the way your grandparents said it, so...
Well, for the longest time, I didn't even correct anyone, but I thought, well, I have a minute, I'll just tell you.
Absolutely, and you know, it's your name, so it is one of those... It's one of those important realities that's worth mentioning on the air.
Well, I don't know, or is it? I mean, if people...
Well, it's
a writer.
A construct, yeah.
Well, no, but I'm saying I'm a writer, right? So people are reading it. So it doesn't really matter if they're mispronouncing it in their mind.
Well, I would argue with that, though, as a radio person and someone who likes to listen. I would hope in my own mind, if there's a particular way I'm supposed to say something, I would want to hear it that way.
Well, okay.
So what's the origin of Klosterman? Where does it come from?
You know, I think it has to do something with, like, the cloisters.
Oh.
Or, I don't know. Then one time someone told me it actually meant... literally man in a closet, which sort of either makes me sound like, you know, like I'm secretly gay or a skeleton or something, you know.
Or you're hiding from everything. Who knows what that's about. Well, in your book, you begin in a way that for we who spend our time interviewing people, it gets very complicated because your entire first chapter is about the strangeness of what we're sitting here doing right now, which is two people who have never met each other having what people, I guess, listening on the radio hope may be an intimate conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you begin your book that way, and what are you doing here if you have such questions about it?
Well, I think what happened is I was just by chance sort of in this, I wouldn't, maybe not unique might be too strong a word, but I was a newspaper journalist and a magazine journalist for about 8 or 10 years. So all I did...
So you sat in my seat for a long time.
Yeah, was conduct interviews, you know. And then when my books came out, all of a sudden... it completely swung the other way, and I would be interviewed way more than I would actually interview people. And that really made me think and rethink, I guess, the kind of the process of the experience. And I was actually doing an interview with a writer from Norway, where my books are not even published.
Not translated into Norwegian.
No, and you know, Norwegians are smart, so they mostly can read English, but I can't imagine many of my books are in Norway. And he's talking to me about, why black metal bands burn down churches. And it's really fun. He's a really funny guy, really interesting person. But somehow in the middle of our dialogue, it suddenly occurred to me this question. It's like, why am I doing this? I mean, I'm not promoting a product in Norway. I don't really have anything that's that important to say about the questions he's answering beyond just trying to entertain him, you know. I've never been to Norway. Maybe he'll never go. And yet, even as I was thinking this, I was trying to come up with things to say and ways to be witty and doing all the things that I had been used to seeing other people do when I interviewed them.
Well, and you also understood as a writer how when your subject does those things, it makes it easier for you. So it sounds like you were kind of trying to be nice to the guy, too.
Oh, well, but there's a whole bunch of things. It's kind of flattering someone's asking you a question. There's a degree of pressure because, if you make a mistake, if I'm interviewing someone and I make a mistake, there's real no – the only downside is for me. It's going to be harder to write that story. But when I'm being interviewed, if I make a mistake, that could very well sort of become
– the center of the story.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's what, as an interviewer, you're often looking for those strange moments when the person is particularly vulnerable or they kind of misspeak or they – talk too much. So then I started wondering what kind of compels us to answer questions, and I started to wonder how much of that compulsion is a manifestation of being so immersed in media that it now seems unnatural not to answer a question that is asked to you for reasons that aren't even social. They're actually like, I guess, metasocial sort of, you know.
And you went to two masters of the interview. You went to Ira Glass and Errol Morris to ask them about what they see their role as in terms of these conversations.
Well, not
or
even
not conversations, they're interviews.
Not
really.
Even to see so much what their role is, but just if they ever have wondered why people answer the questions that they ask. You know, because they're both extremely talented at, particularly like someone like Errol Morris, at getting people who have absolutely no vested interest in talking about their experiences to speak in a pretty narrative way about a lot of times the things that they have done that have been, terrible or weird or strange. And I wondered if they ever thought, why are these people answering my questions?
You know, you said something about the Norwegian interview that's interesting, which is, you know, the interview we're doing right now, you have a book out. So there is a kind of understanding of this is what happens when a book comes out, as you have a conversation about it. But in ways, the conversations that happen beyond those books can reveal something different than having a conversation. That's what Errol Morris and Ira Glass do, is they have the conversations you're talking about, which is not someone is talking about something they've just done. Robert McNamara is talking about something that happened 30 years ago.
Well, and there again, so with someone like Robert McNamara in The Fog of War, it's easy for me to see, well, I can understand why he would have given these interviews. He's an authentically important historical figure. And because he's a very polarizing figure and made a lot of important decisions that some people will never forgive him for, he has to probably feel a desire to contextualize his place in history the way he perceives it. In fact, in The Fog of War, there's a really great moment where he says, you know, when someone asks you a question, you don't answer that question. You answer the question you wish to be asked.
Which is something that PR people tell people all the time.
Yeah.
So
now, like, we're doing this interview, and I know that I'm here to promote this book, and that's, you know, the reason you're having me here. And we're kind of smiling at each other. People can't see this, but you're nodding your head now, and we're having what seems like the kind of conversation we would have if we had been friends for quite a while and hadn't seen each other.
Or if we just met in a bar and you said, hey, I just wrote this book.
Yeah. Although if we just met in a bar, it would actually be closer to an interview than a conversation. Although this interview will be successful if it seems like a conversation. Because I was able to sort of be on both sides of this for a while, like do a lot of interviewing of people and being interviewed quite a bit, sort of the clarity of the inorganic nature of this experience became kind of overwhelming to me almost. Like it seems to be the dominant aspect of any kind of human interaction that's mediated through like a technology. So I just thought, well, I'm going to write about this, and mostly I'm trying, of course, to be entertaining. There are hopefully some ideas in the book too, but it's supposed to just sort of be an interesting way to look at the media that we consume. Yeah.
You also write in terms of human interaction about Americans' reliance on laughter, maybe nervous laughter or inappropriate laughter, but tell us a little bit about your experience in Germany and how this you came to that realization.
Well, I'd always been sort of mystified and obsessed with laugh tracks, television laugh tracks, and philosophically they just seem just idiotic to me. I'm not offended by them, but when you really think of the idea of a machine that tries to tell people when they're supposed to enjoy stuff, that does seem really sort of philosophically flawed.
There was, though, that moment where all disbelief is suspended when you were a little kid, where it was really a part of your experience of watching television.
I was a weird kid, like I guess a lot of kids are, but I used to assume that televisions, the speaker on televisions, were like telephones, that they were kind of a two-way communication device. So when I heard people laughing during WKRP in Cincinnati, I assume that was the sound of other people laughing.
So that were the Smiths down the road, and they were watching too, and you were listening
as well. I would sit next to the TV and laugh directly into the speaker to contribute to like the comedic society. But last summer, I lived in Germany for 4 months. I was teaching a class at the University of Leipzig. And one thing that I very quickly noticed about German society, and this was in East Germany where it was maybe particularly pronounced, unlike Americans, they never laugh at things that aren't funny. Americans tend to use laughter almost as a verbalized pause to almost tell the person they're talking to, I understand we're just sort of having an affable, friendly conversation. But they never do that. So I would be in the grocery store, and I'd be buying, like cookies and beer and bread, and they're really in Germany, they're really into correct change. So they would always be seeing if I had correct change. And as I was searching for it, I would kind of be like, haha, well, let's see. Oh, I don't know if I have any. You know, just sort of like I wasn't even thinking this until I realized the other person was just stoically staring at me. And I started to realize.
And you didn't get back the kind of banter you would get with a cashier here, where they would just, oh, it's okay, just take a minute or.
Well, here's
whatever.
The deal. I would still get the banter. They say all the same things.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they don't use the laughter. And I started realizing how Americans have kind of these three kinds of laugh. They have their sincere laugh, which everyone can tell, but, you know, when something's funny. You know, the fake laugh you use when you're pretending something is funny, you're being polite. But then also this sort of filler laugh, which is used often in completely non-comedic situations, talking to your accountant about something. It's almost like just a way to tell the person that you understand what this conversation is. And I sometimes wonder what the relationship between that and the fact that everybody my age certainly was really raised by syndicated sitcoms that you know, that were shown in the afternoon after school, where laugh tracks were central to every interaction.
So that maybe we learned this rather than it actually being an American thing that the Pilgrims might have done too.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't know how much the Pilgrims were laughing.
They do seem a little more severe than a laughing, maybe more German than that.
The Pilgrims are just interesting in general. One thing, if you're ever in Europe, speaking of Germany, that I always notice is the ground floor over there is zero. And in the U.S., of course, the ground floor is one. And I always think to myself, of all of the things to change your mind about while crossing the Atlantic, why that? Like, one thing we're totally doing is we're changing the way religion is, and no more
ground
zero
floor.
Floor. That's
nothing,
idiotic.
Yeah. Right. A floor can't be zero. It's got to be there, so it's got to be one. I'm speaking with Chuck Klosterman. He is the author of Eating the Dinosaur, which is from Scribner. You range around a lot of different topics. One of the topics you tackle, though, and I guess I just said tackle and I didn't mean to, but you, is football. You love football, and I wanted to ask you one question first, which is, what kind of a football watcher are you? Are you quiet? Do you yell? What is it like if I would be in the room with you watching a football game?
Well, I guess almost totally quiet.
Really?
Well, because I don't really cheer for teams. In fact, for the most part, I don't really root for teams, at least not in the way other people seem to. In that, while I'm watching a game, of course, inevitably there will be a team that I will begin hoping will succeed. But I would never yell at the TV, and I don't yell. I don't know how many years it's been since I've yelled at anything.
It's so funny, because my experience of football is definitely third hand, and it's hearing my dad in the den, which was downstairs from the kitchen, and it sounded like someone was beating him up. Well, and we would say, oh, he's watching football.
Yeah,
so
but
that's
you see,
what's going on.
And this is sort of this is part of that essay to a degree, maybe not as specifically as that, but, you know, there tends to be a schism between people who like sports and who say, like, rock music or film or just culture in general. Very often, there seems to be this idea that these things are separate, and that was never the case for me. And I think part of the reason that has happened is because so often when people say that they like any idiom of anything, sports, music, film, whatever the case, they're really talking about their relationship with other people who like that. And I think that a lot of people who really like popular culture see the idea of someone screaming at the TV or like the drunk guys in the parking lot outside of a Giants game or whatever, and they say, well, I'm not really part of this culture, but they're not really, and they end up criticizing football for that reason. It's like, I hate, like, football's idiotic. But to me, what I'm interested in really is the game itself. I kind of watch football as if it's being played in a vacuum.
So it sounds like, I mean, I never thought my dad was doing, this was his way of mm-hmm. relaxing on a Sunday, and he was such a passionate Giants fan that was, in those days, you just basically sounded like you were getting beat up because they never won. But it sounds like you approach it, and we just have about a minute, but you approach it as a much more intellectual, this is interesting to kind of parse out.
Yeah, well, I see a lot of ideas in the game of football, and I think it's very interesting how football always presents itself very consciously as almost a reactionary conservative game, with this idea that they want to appeal to sort of the overwhelming conservative mindset of America. And yet, to succeed at football as a coach or as a general manager and sort of to watch the evolution of the game, it's actually by far the most liberal sport we have. It's far more liberal than baseball or basketball or hockey in the sense that it really embraces every new idea as positive, which you wouldn't, you know, that football wants to present itself like we're all throwbacks like Brett Favre and it's just these guys who are like old school warriors kind of in this modern age, but it doesn't really operate that way.
Well, in your book, you have football. I know we've only had a chance to talk about football and laughter, but there's a lot more in there. So thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
With Chuck Klosterman, and he has written a book called Eating the Dinosaur. It's from Scribner, and he will be reading and signing books on Tuesday, November 10th at 7 at Borders in Columbus Circle.